Hi, and welcome to episode 51 of Fresh Out of Tokens podcast. This is Tanya, also known as Cypher of Tear, everywhere on the internet. And back with me in the electronic saddle, I guess, is my co-host and producer, David, if you want to say hello.
Hello. We have a good episode ahead of us, I think.
We do, because I am super excited for our guest, because we have Liam Essler, known to many of you from GX Australia, but also a lot of cool game dev stuff.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How are we all?
We're good. It's a little hot here in Chicago for me. I don't know how it is for David over in his part of the world.
It's pretty hot, and I'm in Oregon, so.
Oh, I hate all of you. It's 2 degrees here, Celsius, which is, what's 2 degrees Celsius? 2 degrees Celsius. See, this is Fahrenheit. It is 35.
It's above freezing?
Just.
Well, zero is just freezing in Celsius, right?
Yeah.
Sure. That was a part of math I was never good at, was converting.
I can do, like, well, because when I was working at Obsidian, I lived in Irvine, and so I got used to sort of being like, okay, I know what 60 feels like, I know what 40 feels like, I know what 70 feels like, and I could do it that way, but I could never translate it.
Yeah. If I ever get over to Australia or back to London, I will have to figure out the conversion rate at some point.
We'll all have to refresh our math.
I know. I'll just have to carry around a little converter with me.
Oh, that's a good idea.
But before we get into our questions for you, let's get our usual admin stuff out of the way, which is the not-so-fun stuff. But hey, people listening to the show should know where to find us. So if you are feeling so inclined, we have teas, mugs, and other things in the I Needverse Games Spreadshirt shop. And that is split with 50-50 with our friend Chachi Bobinks, who designed our header and logo. We also have a blog to complement the show, which is at outoftokenscast.com. You would think I'd know this after 50 episodes, but apparently I don't. If you have questions, compliments, feedback on the show, guest ideas, or you want to be a guest, drop us a note at freshoutoftokens@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at outoftokenscast. As always, musical accompaniment for our shows is provided by Mike Moody. You can hear more of her work at soundcloud.com/MikeMoody-1. And with that out of the way...
I think you massively underestimate how fun legal boilerplate is.
Fun?
It's just the best.
This is going to be an interesting episode, y'all. We haven't even got to the questions yet. So I know who you are, Liam, but for those listening who don't know who you are, can you give us a little bit about what you do and who you are way over in Australia? Because for those listening, Liam has been nice enough to get up at like 8 in the morning and talk with us.
I had to leave the house at like 6:30.
Oh my god,
awful.
I'm buying you a beer the next time I see you.
So yeah, I'm Liam. I'm a writer, producer, designer for games, and a diversity advocate, and I'm originally from Adelaide, Australia, and I live in Melbourne, Australia at the moment. I run Australia's Game Developers Conference. I am the event manager for Australia's Game Development Conference, which is called Game Connect Asia Pacific, and I am the co-director of GX Australia, which is the little Australian offshoot of GamerX Australia, which is pretty cool. And I run that with Joshua Meadow from Sydney. And yeah, I have worked on a bunch of games that I'm super proud of and some games that I'm not as proud of. And as we all have in the industry. But yeah, so I do a lot of stuff. I speak a lot. I travel a lot. I mean, I'm no Rami Ismail, but I'm definitely one of the more well-traveled Australian speakers, so.
I feel like Rami's somewhere, like, every week.
Oh, he was here 2 weeks ago. It was great.
Oh,
we had a great
awesome
time.
We have to get him on the show eventually.
You should.
Yes.
Love a bit of Rami.
Yes, he's streaming right now, so.
So that's me.
Yay.
So our usual second question is, what got you into making games? Usually we say what got you into games, but you know, you make games.
I do. It was actually through modding. So I was a modder since I think I so I started playing games about like 7 or 8. The first game I modded was the Creatures series, which was like an artificial life simulator, and I still adore it. It's a fantastic series. I started modding that when I was like 9, and continued modding games for the next 12 years or so, until I went to uni and then eventually got a job at Beamdog. And I think the reason that I actually started making games was because when I was modding, I realized that I actually enjoyed modding more than I enjoyed playing games. And I really enjoyed being able to create content for other people and share it and get their feedback. And I was able to create characters that sort of represented me and represented other people that I cared about in ways that were fun and respectful. And that was pretty weird for games at the time. I think I mostly did that on Baldur's Gate 2 was the game that I modded the most, which, yeah, then got me my job at Beamdog working on Baldur's Gate Enhanced Edition later down the track.
That is so cool.
It is. I don't know. It's kind of interesting that we don't actually see more like marginalized developers who came through modding. It seems like mods are always a good place for them to come from. Like I was recently looking through Morrowind mods a few weeks ago, and Morrowind mods are so like massively slanted toward female gamers that it makes you forget that in Daggerfall, none of the female characters had shirts.
Say what?
Like, oh, Bethesda. Overreaction.
Well.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I think that modding is a really interesting space, because I actually know a lot of sort of diverse developers who've come from modding backgrounds. I mean, modding is a great way to get into the industry. It's a great way to practice our craft and get better at all sorts of things in a really safe way. And I think that the idea of sort of modding as self-authoring, so like authoring your own experience, so taking something that's not made for you and then modifying it in ways that make it more comfortable for you and then playing it is a really powerful thing. And for me, it was definitely one of the primary reasons that I sort of really started enjoying making games or started doing it. And then, yeah, when I got the opportunity to actually work on the game, like that was super cool. And I was able to do all of the same things, but with the official game. And that was super exciting.
Okay, totally random question, but what's been your favorite mod you made?
I think I calculated last year sometime, and I was like, I've maybe released over 60 like large scale mods.
Really?
Yeah, for creatures in Baldur's Gate. My favorite mod would probably be there was an NPC I created for Baldur's Gate 2 called Arath, and he was a human druid with daddy issues. And he was bi, and because I was basically like, I want a romance that I would enjoy, and I want like women to enjoy it too, so I'll make him bi, and the track will basically be the same, except it'll split in some points when there's like gender like specific content, and that was super fun, and I still am a huge fan of that character, and some of the best fan mail I've ever received was for Arath. Actually, I had a lot of messages saying that it was pretty much the only romance that people had played where they really felt connected to the character and they actually cared about the character, and he was interesting and complex and worked in unexpected ways. And that was really gratifying to me as sort of a baby writer. And I look back at the content now and kind of cringe and go like, oh God, it's so bad. But there are still so many things about that character and his character arc and the way that he fit into the game that I was super proud of. And he was definitely like one of my first major forays into creating diverse content for a game that isn't that diverse. And it was really well received. And I think the Baldur's Gate modding community was particularly open and appreciative of queer content, which was really nice. Some of my friends from the UK, a lesbian couple, who I've yet, like, I still haven't met them yet, but I've known them for over 15 years, and they created some of the first queer content for the Baldur's Gate series, and that was super cool, and now one of them is actually getting into games, and I've been sort of helping her on her way, which is really cool, yeah.
That's so awesome. But speaking of LGBTQIA content, that is a mouthful.
It is.
What games have you worked on that have content for the queer community?
Baldur's Gate Enhanced Edition and Baldur's Gate 2 Enhanced Edition and Baldur's Gate Siege of Dragonspear all have queer content. And so I did a QA on Baldur's Gate Enhanced Edition, so I wasn't really involved in any of the creative side. And then I started working on Baldur's Gate 2 Enhanced Edition as a scripter, and then I was promoted to like lead scripter, which is basically like lead technical designer, I guess. Then after that, I was looking... created these, there were several characters that were queer before I got there, like they were already in the plan. And that was super cool. One of them was Dawn, and he's a chaotic, evil, like bloodthirsty orc who's bi. And they also created this new character called Hexat, who was a lesbian vampire who's black. And she was a really interesting character. And I remember basically when I saw the brief, I was like, oh God, this is the minority character. Like they've put everything they could, they've just pumped into this one character because they couldn't afford to like mush it out into several.
Oh dear.
And yeah, I was like, oh no, this could be super bad. I was mostly, I'm a huge fan of romance. If you hadn't guessed yet, I love romance. I think that it is an incredibly powerful tool to create player engagement, and I think it's really enjoy exploring sort of human relationships and stuff like that in my writing. And so when I was working on Baldur's Gate 2 Enhanced Edition, and I was like, oh, these characters have romances, I got involved in the writing side of things, and so I ended up writing the majority of 3 of the 4 romances for BG2E, the new ones. And I did Rasad, who was a human monk, and I did Hexat, and I did Dawn. And I unfortunately didn't have a lot of time to write them. I think I had 2 days per character to write these like lengthy romance tracks, I didn't sleep a lot. But it was insane. I think crunch on BG2E was pretty crazy. But I got the opportunity to write like this lesbian romance, and so I went and I spoke to a lot of my lesbian friends and sort of asked like, what are you looking for in a romance? Like, what kind of content do you want to see? How do you want to be approached by the character, etc.? And then after doing that, went back and sort of wrote these dialogues and wrote the romance into the story. It was a really, really interesting process because I'd never written a lesbian character before, for one. And so I would really try to write it for my lesbian friends, like for a lesbian audience.
Mm-hmm.
And basically that one was done. And then I did Dawn, which was really difficult. Like, he's this like evil, like crazy, bloodthirsty half-orc who falls in love with you, and trying to reconcile that as a writer was really quite difficult. And so it ended up being more about a power play, and he does care about you, but it's in this like weird twisted way. It's very dark. I was still it comes across quite rapey at times, which now makes me feel very uncomfortable, and so we actually edited some of the dialogues post because it just got into territory that was like, it's hard to talk about sort of really like relationships in which there's power play without it coming across really badly. So it was definitely a learning experience, and I'm really proud of what I created, even if like looking back, I'd probably do it differently now. It was a really interesting experience because I got to create some of the first queer content, like actively queer content for the Baldur's Gate series. And so I co-wrote those with Andrew Foley, who is the lead writer. Then after release, I got one of the probably the email that set me on my current career path or confirmed my career path as a diversity advocate. And it was from a woman who basically said that she was really struggling with her identity, her sexual identity, and her gender identity. And she had played Hexat's romance. It was so clearly written for her. And that was the only time that had ever happened in a game. And she said, you know, she was feeling, she was suicidal and she was really struggling with herself. And playing through this romance really helped her to sort of come to terms with her identity and accept who she was. And I was like, oh, I didn't intend for that to happen, but I'm so glad that that was the case. And I actually never replied because I didn't know what to say at the time. I was just so flabbergasted. And now I can't find the email, which just tears me apart. But it was definitely that moment where sort of I received that feedback on my work that was like, yes, you're doing the right thing. There are people who are going to appreciate the content that you're creating. And yeah, it was really, really cool and validating. And then Baldur's Gate Siege of Dragonspear, I don't think I ended up, I don't think the queer content that I wrote ended up making it into the game. I think that Amber Scott, who's was one of the writers as well, I think that she ended up rewriting it because the character changed a little. But I wrote a bunch of the romance for that as well. And that was really cool. I think I wrote Dawn's romance and one of the other ones. But it was a really interesting experience.
That's so really cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I will have to make time to stream it.
Yeah.
Me and my Echo.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I think like Hexat's still kind of a problematic character because she is this fusion of different stereotypes. And she copped a lot of flack for being this like triumvirate of diversity. I think we did fairly well despite that sort of handicap. But my main problem with Hexat was when you initially meet the character, it's actually this you meet this white woman who is very, she's basically a zombie. Like, all, like, she can't really talk. All she can say is, like, I need to go to Dragomir's tomb. And so you have her in the party, and she's pretty and white, and that's fine and whatever. And so you go to this tomb, you complete the puzzles in the tomb, and at the end of the tomb, this vampire appears, kills the pretty white girl, and then essentially takes her place in the party, and it's this black lesbian vampire. And players had a huge problem with this. Like, there were so many racist fucks who came onto our forums being like, I want, like, Clara, I want the white girl back. And then once they'd be like, oh, they'd essentially be like, we preferred her personality. We felt she was a much better character. But, you know, as the writers of the character, we were like, she literally had no personality. She was literally a blank slate who would constantly just said, I want to go to Dragomir's tomb. But she was white and she was pretty. And she got replaced by this black woman. And oh my god, I saw red for like a whole week there. We had to ban our lead writer from posting on the forums because
oh my god.
He kept writing these like diatribes against these racist people.
Oh wow.
And so it was super confronting. It was really interesting. And
gee, I wonder what that's like, Liam.
I know, right? I grew up fairly sheltered and, you know, I've got black friends and stuff.
Sarcasm quote there for those listening.
Like, it was really enlightening because I hadn't seen much of that sort of directed at me. I mean, it wasn't directly at me. It was at something that I'd helped create. But it was really, I learned a lot, basically. And it taught me a lot about people and how players react to things. And we'll talk about this a little bit more later, I think, when we talk about the article. But player entitlement is a thing. And it's very, very, it was very, very interesting to go through that situation and to realize just how heavily ingrained racism is in some people, particularly like your stereotypical quote unquote gamer audience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not that you would know anything about that.
not at all.
Not at all. No.
Before we get bogged down in this and I start cussing. I think David wanted to ask you something before I, because I'll just start cussing and we'll just have to like delete the whole episode and start over.
So yeah, the next question we had was GX Australia is the first LGBTQIA gaming con in Australia. It might have been faster to just say non-heteronormative.
There you go.
What prompted you to create a version of GamerX Australia?
Well, A, it was always too expensive for me to go. And that always pissed me off because I was always like, oh, I really would love to go to GamerX. It definitely seems like my kind of place. And I was at GDC, the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco last year. And this was around March. I was with Matt Conn, the founder of GamerX, at the Gay Gaming Professionals Party. And we were drunk and we were having a good time and hanging out. And just as a joke, he was like, hey, how about GamerX Australia, huh? And I was like, yeah, that would be so much fun, blah, blah, blah. We had a laugh and sort of like left the topic there and that was fine. And then the next day I was like, actually, that would be really cool. And then I wouldn't have to pay to go to the state to go to GamerX. And around the same time, Joshua Meadows from Sydney, who at the time was running Sydney Gamers with a Y, was thinking similar things. He'd been wanting to create a GX in Australia for many years. And so we started talking. We did some initial surveys to determine interest and felt that there was sufficient interest to go ahead with it. Yeah, so we started putting it together and put together the Kickstarter and ran that and pulled together $55,000 and then minus fees, which was $50,000, which was great. Yeah. And then we had it earlier this year. So that was very exciting.
That was so awesome. And it was nice that it was streamed on Twitch. So like, you know, as long as I was willing to stay up till odd hours, I could watch panels, which I did because it was great. So being the first non-heteronormative event, because that is a mouthful of letters.
I usually use the word queer.
True.
Because it's a nice umbrella term. Not everyone likes it, but it's one
shorter.
Of the commonly accepted ones, and it's shorter.
I'm straight, so when I say it, some people do have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can get away with it, because I'm gay.
And I'm bi, so
mm-hmm.
I was going somewhere. So, you know, since it was the first event for, you know, for queer gamers and the queer gaming community, How well was it received when both when you announced it and when it happened?
When we announced it, there was a lot of confusion from particularly straight gamers as to why it was necessary. And that was really interesting. I mean, it's a totally valid question. And if you are not a minority, I can absolutely understand why you might not understand how important having a space like GX is. So yeah, I wrote during the Kickstarter, Mark Serrells, who's the editor of Kotaku Australia, asked me to pen a piece answering that question, like, why is this important? And so I did that, and the comment section was very interesting. I think you can imagine what it was like.
Is that the polite way of saying it was a trash fire?
It was like a trash fire with like little parts of it that weren't quite as burny as other parts. So there were definite parts where there were just embers and not flame. And we managed to, I think we changed quite a few minds actually. It was an interesting experience going through that and having to really, I guess, fight for why it was necessary in a really public forum where I was being personally attacked. And the general consensus ended up being like, yeah, like, cool. I'm glad that there's another gaming event in Australia. I don't understand why it has to be queer. And I was like, okay, well, that's good to know. And so I took that into account when we were doing all of our marketing and PR. And we made sure to address that. And I think that we were really quite successful, which is really cool. And then the actual event itself was hugely successful and was incredibly well received. I've run a lot of events and a bunch of conferences. And this was the only one that I've ever run where the feedback was almost unanimously positive. And that, yeah, it's really, really rare, like bizarrely rare to have almost everyone, even people who have a negative experience, kind of be like, this was my favorite convention ever. There was this one minor thing that happened that I didn't like, but it was really minor and it was fine. And to hear that kind of feedback was really validating and, yeah, really special. I think that we worked incredibly hard to make it as welcoming and accepting as we could. We changed the name, so it wasn't GamerX Australia, it was GX Australia. That was a very conscious decision. All of our marketing and like all of the messaging that we, every piece of text that went out about GX Australia had the word queer in it. We never wanted to use the word gay because we felt it was super exclusionary. We made sure to encourage straight gamers to come as well and allies. We made it as trans inclusive as we could. We made it as inclusive to people of color and people who are gender diverse as we could. And when we got to the event itself, I mean, like we'd been to GamerX, and so we were hoping that we would be able to replicate that atmosphere of inclusion, which is really special to GamerX. And it was really cool because we totally did that, and I feel like maybe even more than GamerX in the States, because even though like GX is an incredibly inclusive environment, but it's only been over the last few years that really things like racial inclusion and talking about issues of race and ethnicity and culture have come to the forefront. Whereas for us, it was because we'd had the experience of going to GamerX and seeing it evolve, we were able to kind of incorporate all of that from the get-go. And that was really cool. And the feedback that we got from people was just like every GamerX, like, more people of color, please. And we were like, yep, we know. It's always an issue trying to get, especially in Australia, like we really wanted to get Indigenous Australian representation at the event. And we worked incredibly hard to do that. And unfortunately, there's just no one that we could find who would fit any category. But it was like once we sort of explained what had happened, everyone was like, we're going to go find you. And that was awesome.
Yeah. One of my friends who was there was that was kind of her Twitter feedback.
Yeah, and I chatted to her a bunch about it as well.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool. Like that was probably the only even remotely negative piece of feedback, and it was always the way that people would present it was like, this was probably my favorite con. I just wish, or like I had an amazing experience. It would have been nice if, rather than like kind of going like, this was shit because. So it, you know, people had a really good experience, even the people who felt like there were things that could have been done better. And it's the first time that's ever happened at any event that I've run. And that was really cool. Like I really appreciated that. And I'm glad that everyone had a really great time. And like, I know I was really surprised and kind of disappointed that there wasn't more feedback because as an event manager, like the more negative feedback there is, the better it is for me in a way, because I know what to do next and I know where to take it next. Whereas this was just like, yes, it was good. More people of color. I'm like, okay, well, that's very helpful. Great. We'll definitely get more people of color, and we'll just do the same thing next year, I guess. Yeah, but I think there were some really interesting conversations had. The thing that made me really happy was we had a lot of straight white guys come up to us and tell us that they got it. Good. And they didn't get it before. Like, it was something that I wasn't expecting. I knew that there was a bunch of straight people there because I'd actively gone out of my way to invite them to make the atmosphere actually diverse. And to have, you know, your quote-unquote stereotypical straight white guy come up to you and say, thank you for running this event. I thought that I understood these issues. I had no idea. And now I do, thanks to your event. That was really cool to know that we got the chance to educate some people about the way the world works in reality rather than the way that they thought it did. And yeah, it was definitely a cool experience to have that happen. And it was really unexpected.
That's so awesome.
Speaking, of course, of the convention, you had some rock star bosses of honor at the first GX Australia. What was the process like, and what were some of the difficulties in getting folks you wanted? Like, how did you decide who, and did you have to find them, or did they find you? I assume it probably varied, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a little bit of everything. I mean, we started, like, we did everything by looking at GamerX in the States. Matt and the team have done such an amazing job of putting that event together, and their guests are always totally on point. We basically took that as a challenge, and we were kind of like, well, if you do it this way, we want to do it better. We want to one-up you. So Joshua and I spent a lot of time working out who we wanted to be represented, what issues we felt were important. We basically spent the month just hashing out the issues that we wanted to be talked about, and what we wanted the messages to be, what we wanted the culture to feel like. And then we tried to pick guests that exemplified those issues and were able to talk to those issues in a really intelligent, interesting way, and were big names as well, because being a first year event in a country that has no idea what GamerX is, really difficult. And we knew that we would need to get some press attention, and we would need, in order to do that, we would probably need to have some big names. We sat down and we were like, right, we want these people, these minorities represented. We feel these issues are important. And then we just tried to find people who are at the cross sections of these. I'm lucky enough to know a lot of cool people in the RPG industry in particular. I'm good friends with Chris Avalon. And so he was one of the first people that I talked to about it. And he's not really, I wouldn't say that Chris is super known for his diversity advocacy, because he never really does it publicly, but he spends a lot of time talking to people about diversity. Quite.
Really?
Yeah.
He's like my secret Twitter crush.
Yeah. He's, apart from being basically the nicest, most intelligent guy, he spends a lot of time working hard to make the industry more diverse in many different ways. And he never gets recognition for it because he never does any of it publicly. And so he was one of the first people I had a conversation with. I was like, I need my like token straight guy. Do you want to be my token straight guy? And he was like, hell yeah. Like, anytime you ask me to come to something, I'll come. I'm like, okay, cool. And so Chris was one of the first bosses we got on board. And then I went to Tim Kaine, who also works at Obsidian and was the creator of Fallout and is gay. And so I asked him and his husband, Robert Land, who is a designer at Obsidian, if they would come down. And unfortunately, Robert wasn't able to come. Because, yeah, it was really sad because I wanted to bring them over for Mardi Gras. But Tim came down and had an amazing time. And that was a really big deal because Tim doesn't do conventions, or he doesn't do shows. It is super rare for him to do a show. And so we kind of had to convince him a little to come down. And I think now he's guesting at GamerX in the States. So that's really cool. He'll be there as the Boss of Honor this year. And from there, once we sort of had those, I was like, right, okay, we need a nice mix of national or Australian and international. And so I started to talk to my network in Australia, and we got Ray Johnston on board, who's, she was our only Indigenous guest, but she's a news personality. She's a journalist. She works for Gizmodo, and she's amazing. She's a cosplayer. She is well known for her Wonder Woman cosplays in Australia, and she hosts cosplay championships all around the country, which is really cool. And so we had her come on board. We're super lucky to have her. and she talked about issues of race and, you know, issues of representation, which was super cool from a woman's perspective. And we had Eve Beauregard, who's a really famous cosplayer who's bi, and that was really cool. We had Dylan Zena from the States, 8-Bit Homo, who's lovely. It was really awesome to have him come down and hang out with us for the con. Jeez, we had so many cool guests.
And Manvia,
I'm literally having to go to my guest list to remind myself who we had. Yeah, so Manvia was the next one that we got after we talked to Ray and Ali, or Eve. Basically sent me a message like, please come to our tiny little convention in Australia. And he was like, oh, but GDC is like not long after. Kind of went away. He was like, you know what? I'll do GX Australia and I won't do GDC. And that was awesome. We were so pleased that he made that decision. I felt very honored that he would choose us over GDC. But he is an incredible diversity advocate and gave one of the few talks at GDC that has received an incredible standing ovation, along with Number One Reason to Be and a lot of the other amazing panels. So he's fantastic. And he's also one of the most lovely guys who's very outspoken about diversity. And then we had like local games makers like Luke Miller, who made My Ex-Boyfriend the Space Tyrant, which is possibly the most gay game to ever exist.
It looks fantastic.
It's a lot of fun. It's been very camp.
It has been on my wish list for a while.
It's worth checking out. And we had Kitty Powers, who made Kitty Powers Matchmaker, and is one of the few drag queens I know is incredibly passionate, really actually passionate about diversity, is incredibly trans inclusionary, and very outspoken about these issues in and out of the industry. Because Kitty, also known as Richard Frank, is actually a game developer and works at Media Molecule. He worked on Tearaway, and I think he worked on Little Big Planet. And he's amazing. And so we were incredibly lucky to have him come down from the UK. We had David Gator, who, you know, has been to every GamerX now, actually. I think it's him and Matt. I think they are possibly the only people who've been to every GamerX. And he's now creative director at Beamdog. So it was really lovely to have him down. We had Aussie Gamerchick, who's a really well-known Australian YouTuber and blogger. We had Lisi Kane, who's the producer at A League of Geeks. She's an incredible game developer who runs Girl Geek Academy here in Australia. And, you know, just, I mean, I'm missing a bunch of people. And we had Matt Conn and Philip Jones from GamerX, Read Only Memories and Gaming in Color. And who else? Gemma Roberts, who's an amazing video games researcher. We had, and most importantly, we had Jordan Raskopoulos, who is the front woman for Axis of Awesome, which is a really, really well-known Australian comedy band. She reached out to us. She's trans, and before she came out, I reckon like 4 months before she came out, she actually got in touch with us and was like, I think your event is fucking awesome, and I need to be involved however I can, but I'm only going public the week before. Is it okay? Is it okay if this is the first event that I come to as a trans woman? And we were like, fuck yeah. Like, please join us.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, no, it was incredible. And then we were lucky enough to have Alex Greenwich, who's the member, the government representative, essentially, for Sydney. And we had Clover Moore, who's the mayor of Sydney. And they opened the event, which was pretty amazing. And it's the first time that I think it's the first time that a GamerX has been opened by a member of parliament or a member of government.
Pretty sure it is.
Yeah, so that was really special to have our community recognized in that way by government. And yeah, they said some really nice things about us, which was nice.
That is so cool. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to start saving my pennies so I can come next year, hopefully.
Yes.
So I know we talked about this kind of pre-broadcasting or pre-recording, but I'm kind of hoping and giving you puppy eyes that no one can see. Anything you can tell us about the next event?
It's happening. Beyond that, nothing is set in stone yet. So I could tell you things, but I'd just be lying.
Damn it.
I can tell you sweet, sweet lies if you like.
You can tell me sweet lies when we're not recording, so then there's no evidence of said lies.
But it's definitely happening.
Yay.
It'll be happening in 2017. We're currently in the process. We actually had our kickoff meeting last week, and so we're currently trying to work out where the venue will be. Because while we loved the venue for last year, it was also heinously expensive and not sustainable for us in the term. So we're trying to work out what time of year to do it and where we're going to do it. And then once we've got those nailed down, we'll start to put things together and run a Kickstarter again. Oh, God. and do all of that fun stuff and really get the Australian community galvanized again for GXOz2.
All right. Well, keep us posted. We want the scoop.
I will. I'll be spamming it like nobody's business as soon as anything is public.
All right.
This may just be because I don't pay enough attention to Australia, but do you see more LGBTQIA events coming to Australia now that GX Australia has happened?
I would like to think so. Australia actually has a lot of LGBTQIA plus events already. We have Mardi Gras, which is one of the biggest queer events in the world, like Mardi Gras Sydney. We have the Feast Festival in Adelaide, which is, again, like a huge queer festival. Australia is quite lucky to have a lot of queer events. And there are, like, Gamer with a Y groups all over Australia as well, and they're really great. I don't know if we'll see, like, extra convention popping up. I would like to see that happen, just because, you know, being in Sydney makes it difficult for some people to make it to GX Australia. I would like to see something in Perth or something like that. But I also know, like even for us, it was super hard to just pull it all together and to get the audience that we needed in order to make it viable. And doing it somewhere like Perth, for example, would make it much harder because it's much more remote. So rather than focusing on trying to encourage people to make queer events, we tend to encourage people to make more diverse events, if that makes sense. So things like events like PAX Australia, I work quite closely with the PAX team because I run Australia's Game Developers Conference and they dovetail. And so me and Yug, who's the manager of PAX in Australia, spend a lot of time talking about how PAX Australia can be made better for queer people and minorities. And PAX Australia is definitely the most diverse and inclusive PAX of all of them as a result. So yeah, we spend a lot of time trying to encourage Australian events to be more inclusive rather than sort of creating a bunch of ancillary events specifically for minorities, just because like it's Australia's population is basically California.
Okay.
So while Australia is huge, it's the size of the United States. You know, we have a lot less people. It is actually a lot harder to put together big events. And so, yeah, we focus our efforts on trying to make the existing events and new events just be more inclusive and more thoughtful about the way that they present themselves and the kind of content they have, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been really successful with that.
Huh. Well, speaking of the U.S. and Australia, damn you, Echo, I don't know where you came from. you know, there are challenges, I'm sure, that are unique to Australia versus what you've seen in the U.S. So have you seen or experienced trying to have representation and better that are unique to your audience in Australia versus maybe what you've seen with GamerX in the U.S.?
There are different. One of them is that while Australia is incredibly progressive, I think that representations of sexuality are a little bit less well-regarded in Australia. So where GamerX in the U.S. can have sponsors like Grindr, we could never do that because really? It's just not regarded quite as well. People don't talk about these things quite as open, which is why it's so important that we have events like this. And so I think in Australia, there's a lot of surface level acceptance. But as soon as you start talking about sex and stuff like that, it's like, oh, no, God, we don't want to know that. That's gross. So that was definitely a factor when we were putting it together, working out ways that we could be more inclusive and try to expose people to new ideas without crossing the line, which is in a different place, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Australia is also, like, I don't know if you know this, but Australia is very racist. We have, like the United States, we have a pretty fucking awful history with racism, both with the indigenous population of Australia and immigrants. And it's something that is probably my least favorite thing about being Australian. It's something that I think a lot of us are very ashamed of. And so when we were putting it together, we definitely, there are different issues that we had to solve and different issues we had to talk about than in the States. For example, like we have a much larger Asian population comparatively because we're much closer to Asia than we do like a Black population, for example. So we knew from the get-go that, you know, we weren't going to have as many attendees who were Black and we weren't going to have as many guests who were Black just because where we are in the world, like Australia just doesn't have that kind of diversity. So that like the kind of diversity that we focused on was very different in terms of ethnicity. And when we were having these discussions, like by the time that we realized just how different it was a little bit late to invite guests who would solve some of the issues that we were seeing, which was really frustrating for us, but is definitely something that now we know to focus on next year, which is great, I guess. But yeah, like, it's, while we're not talking to people, like, the amount of subtle casual racism that occurs in Australia, and I know it does in the States as well, but it's just different, and it happens in different ways, and the conversations are different. And I guess that the genocide of the Indigenous population in Australia is a lot more recent. Like, the Stolen Generation, which was a terrible event that, in which basically white Australia decided that Aboriginal children would be better off if they raised them white. And so they went in and they took all of these children from the Indigenous population and raised them in convent and housing. And this was in the 40s, I think. And basically, so they call it the Lost Generation or the Stolen Generation. This only happened like in the 1940s. Like, these people are alive today. So, like, it's a lot fresher. There's a lot more to consider. The wounds are a lot more raw. So there's definitely, yeah, it's just different, I guess, just different things to consider, different issues to talk about and discuss. Like, for example, we felt that it was very important that we have like a welcome to country, which is a traditional Australian greeting and acknowledgement that the land that we're on is the land of like the particular tribe that or peoples that were living in the area, and thanking them and their elders for allowing us to use that space. Things like that were become much more important, and just acknowledgement and discussion. It's very interesting once you get into it, and just it gave us a really different perspective once we actually really seriously sat down and started talking about it and talking with other people about it and consulting. It was definitely an experience, and we learned a lot from it about how we can be more inclusive to ethnic minorities primarily in Australia. Because we didn't realize just how different the makeup was from the States. And we were definitely looking at the States as a model when we really should have just looked at Australia and gone, like, okay, what have we got here? Like, what are the issues here? And we definitely addressed some of those. And we worked really, really hard to try to do that. But it was definitely a learning experience. And I feel like we're going to do a lot better next year now that we have a better idea of what we should be doing, I guess. For example, like, there's also a lot of, just like in the States, a lot of racism towards Islam and, or not racism, a lot of hate towards Islam and a lot of racism towards people from the Middle East. You know, I tend to think that games are one of the best ways that we can solve social ills and we can talk about these issues. So next year, like, you can bet your ass there's going to be some, like, Muslim guests and we're going to be talking about this shit because it's super important. And so that's the kind of stuff that's kind of a little different. It's just who's in Australia and what the issues are versus what it is in the US.
Yeah. I don't know if you had a chance to go to Rami's talk or if you had a chance to watch the video.
Yeah,
but his GC talk was amazing.
Yeah. So Farah is a really good friend of mine. She was on that panel. And so we talk about these things a lot.
Yeah, that was really cool. Okay, now I have all the food for thought. So Jason, take the next question, because I'm just like, I know I have all these ideas, which is bad because we're podcasting.
I know, right? I was like, I'm so sorry for making you think. This should be light and fluffy.
No, we can be not so light and fluffy. We have had some serious episodes and serious moments, but this is the kind of stuff conversation I want to have on the show.
Yeah.
So that's good. Make us think, because a lot of people here need to think about these things too.
I think that, yeah, like, just recognizing that every area of the world has different issues that are often not discussed, and then really digging into those, I think, is going to be really important for us as we move forward. Just recognizing that. While there are many shared issues, there are probably lots of issues locally that we're in really good a good place to address, I guess, and that's what GX should be about, in my eyes.
Anyway. I suppose the last thing we really want to know before we move to the next section of the podcast is, what's next for you? What do you have coming up? Anything exciting?
Not a lot that I can talk about yet. I'm working on a game with a Kiwi studio, so a New Zealand-based studio, which is really cool, writing that. Game Connect Asia Pacific is happening later this year during Melbourne International Games Week, which we help run. So I work for the Game Developers Association of Australia to run GCAP. And then, so that's the 1st or 2nd of November. If you are in the Australia Pacific region, you should drop by. It's a lot of fun. It's definitely my favorite conference, which is why I joined the team to help run it and eventually became the event manager. So that's really exciting. I'm doing some really cool things there with Tony Reed, who's the CEO of the GDAA. working with a lot of indies locally to make cool games and help them improve their narrative. I've been talking to the New Zealand Game Developers Conference, so I'll be speaking there later this year. I'll be speaking at Dev/World, which is a mobile developers conference. Just basically lots of talking. Me being on stage talking shit a lot. Yeah.
Very, very cool. So sometimes what we do is, if there's something relevant going on in the industry, or just in general, we like to talk about it. And, you know, we're all gamers. And as you said earlier, the subject of entitlement comes up. So anyone listening probably has seen the article we're going to talk about, which has been received in very interesting and sometimes very hostile ways by Devin Farasi. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. But it's an article called Fandom is Broken. And that didn't go well with a lot of people. So I was wondering, as our guest, what your thoughts were on that article. And then we also have a kind of follow-up that was posted elsewhere the day after this came out.
I think that the Fandom is Broken article is super interesting for many different reasons. I think mm-hmm. that it has some really important points and some points that I disagree with. The reason that Devin is talking about it is because of Captain America being, sorry for everyone who is reading the comics and not there yet, but Captain America has been working for Hydra this whole time. For a lot of people, Captain America holds a really special place in their heart, and they've grown up with this character being this shining pinnacle of what it is to be American and what it is to believe in freedom and justice. And to have this shining beacon of goodness suddenly be revealed as a double agent of evil sent a lot of people reeling. And so what do people do when they're unhappy on the internet? They abuse people. And so there were a lot of people who were basically like, this is bullshit. And they felt like they had some, because they cared about the character so much, they feel like they have some ownership over what happened to that character. And we call this entitlement. They're entitled to the stories that they want to see. Devin's article sort of goes into this in a lot of detail, and it's really, really interesting. And I like from my perspective as a writer, I mean, I've definitely experienced this where like I've written things like, see, Baldur's Gate Siege of Dragonspear is a prime example. Amber wrote, there was a trans character in Siege of Dragonspear called Mizena. And Amber wrote this character. A lot of gamergate-y types felt that this character was very, very, well, it shouldn't have been in the Baldur's Gate saga because they were trans. And the Baldur's Gate saga was not a space that diversity should happen in. They had grown up with this game, and it was their quote-unquote safe space. They didn't have to confront things that they weren't comfortable with, and it was theirs. And then we came in, and we, you know, made it more diverse. We, you know, I'm doing quote fingers here, but like we forced a progressive agenda on this game. And there were a lot of people who were really unhappy with that because they felt they were entitled to the game that they wanted rather than the game that we wanted to create. And I think that this tension between consumer and creator is something that's been around for a very, very long time. But with the advent of the internet, where we can express our opinions instantly and anonymously, there's definitely been a rise in this idea of entitlement, and the Mass Effect 3 ending is a great example of this. There have been many others where fans of various IP or TV shows, etc., have expressed outrage or disappointment in how certain shows are run or when they've been cancelled, and have worked hard to try to bring them back or to get them cancelled. And this is, it's in one on one side, it's great. It means that the people who are consuming the content that we're creating, the people who love what we're doing, really love what we're doing. They're very invested in the things that we're creating. So yeah, that's fantastic. It means that we're doing something right. If you care about something, obviously you're going to have opinions about it. And that's totally fine. It's totally okay to care about something and want certain things to happen. Like, for example, when I watched Civil War, I wished that Cap and Bucky had gotten together because I felt as a writer, that storyline would have made a lot more sense if Captain America and Bucky were in love. It just makes the whole thing is basically a love story or a bromance story. And so I was like, yeah, I think that they should totally have gotten together. The difference is when you express that opinion via threats or abuse, Yeah, Devin goes into this a little bit further in the next in his follow-up, where he talks about the fact that, because in his original article, he basically equates people abusing creators with people asking for more diverse characters. And then in his follow-up, he explains that more and says that's actually not what he was saying, and he goes into it in detail. And I really admire him for writing this, because it, you know, made a lot more sense than his little quip in the first one. He's a passionate advocate for more diversity in media. And so, you know, it was important that he write this follow-up piece. Yeah, like the whole situation's been super interesting. What's sort of been your take on it?
My take on it is I was kind of giving the article a side eye, the original article, because I just felt like he was kind of taking to task fans in general. But then reading the follow-up piece, you know, really quickly before we started recording, you know, made it a lot clearer, and I wish that clarity had been in the first piece.
Yeah.
And as someone who writes and is published on occasion, it's very easy to know what your intent was, but that doesn't matter once it's out in the wild.
Death is the author and all that.
Death of the author, but, you know, intent is not magic. Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure, you know, you deal with it, and David does RPG stuff.
Edit fiction, so just joking.
And you also edit fiction. So we all have that experience with, we might get the picture of what someone is trying to say, or our own experience, you know, colors that perception. But once it's out in the wild, you can't take it back. And I thought specifically the Mass Effect ending, because I came to Mass Effect way after I came to Dragon Age. And I, you know, people are going to yell at me, but I actually wish that BioWare had not done that. I wish they left the ending as it was, because it is what it is. That was the vision for the game at the time.
Yeah.
And even now, people still bring it up. It has been, what, 4 or 5 years at this point? And actually, while I was walking around GamerX at the end of it with David Gator and Dan Plunkett, who also is a BioWare, and someone who was like, oh my god, I really want to meet them, I'm such a big BioWare fan, brought that up, and they didn't even touch Mass Effect. So, you know, that can kind of, that not letting go of something, and yes, there are things about all the franchises that I dislike or I wish were done differently, but it's not going to change it, and it's not going to help creators want to work with fans and work with what could work better, maybe, if a fan brings it up. If you're going to harp on something for 5 years, it's not going to change anymore. Let it go. So I don't know. I just felt like the first article, I wish the first article had the clarity of the follow-up.
Yeah. And I would encourage anyone who read the original and hasn't read the follow-up to read the follow-up, because it does clarify a number of things about the original article. And sort of gives it that additional context that is kind of necessary to understanding where the author is coming from.
Yeah, and in the first piece, Devin also references the AV Club article, which we'll link to in the show notes as well as his follow-up piece. But then there was another one that was received a lot better, I think, that came out on May 31st in Biblio Days, yep. Which I'd not heard of until people started linking this article. And it's about the false equivalence of fan culture, because the other thing that has been coming up a lot is the new Ghostbusters film.
Mm.
And David, before I jump into that other article, what thoughts did you have about the whole, like, fan entitlement issue?
Honestly, I think that, the conversation we're having, I haven't seen anyone really mention that just a few years ago we were having a conversation about the unprecedented breaking down of the barriers between creators and consumers, and how that was going to be a wonderful thing. The state of the lanes of communication is awful, but we have torn down these walls, like, as a society on purpose. So we probably need to come up with some new safeguards.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily terrible that creators and fans can interact.
I guess the creators didn't realize they wouldn't always get to control the conversation.
I think that it's really interesting, because there's this really clear divide between creators that existed before this happened and creators that have grown up with this. Because, like, as a creator who's grown up in the internet age, I'm 25, I've had the internet, I've grown up with the internet. And for me, it's totally normal and natural that a fan base and a creator would have a really close and sort of intimate dialogue, I guess, because that's what my experience has been like as a creator the whole time I've been creating, even when I was a modder. And though I abhor the abuse that we see, and I've been on the receiving end of a bunch of it, but nowhere near as much as many women creators and female creators and advocates. I think that, you know, for the most part, that the fact that we can communicate with our audiences so directly is a good thing. It means that we can understand what they want. We can get feedback really quickly. We can engage in a mostly productive dialogue a lot of the time. It's very unfortunate that with that comes this dark underbelly of abuse and death threats and rape threats and disgusting, abhorrent, you know, patriarchal culture, I guess.
Yeah.
But there are definite upsides to it as well.
Yeah.
Also, you know, people shouldn't be dicks.
Well, everyone be nice.
We should include that. We just all thought people were better than they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the greater internet dickwad theory apply when erecting. Well, because that's what I liked about the other piece that I threw in the show notes, which was from Biblio Days, where it takes a lot more nuanced look at this idea of creators and things like that, because it's very frightening to read the Ferocity piece and see this person threaten in caps about Captain America, which kind of goes together in a very odd linguistic way, about a character that is very clearly important to them, but actually threatening death over something that at the end of the day is something where they could just go, okay, I'm not going to buy the comic anymore. I'm not going to support this franchise anymore. So to me, it just seems like we have gone from, I don't like this thing, so I'm not going to buy it. I'm going to tell my friends not to buy it, to, oh my God, creators should die.
Yeah, that's not great.
You know, the studio behind No Man's Sky, there was an article today or yesterday in Pataku that Patrick Klepek wrote that he's getting death threats because there's a delay for No Man's Sky. And it's like, well, you realize if anyone carries out this death threat, we'll never get the game. Which sounds terrible, but it's a logical conclusion. If you're going to threaten somebody with death over delay, you know, death is kind of a permanent delay if that's how you're feeling about it.
And also kind of like, these are games.
Well, I guess for me, I can't understand such a deep investment that we've gone from, I'm upset about this content, to this is content I don't like, to I'm going to kill you, and, you know, doing things like calling in bomb threats to what the Sony CEO's plane had to do an emergency landing. Why this is now an acceptable response at such a level of vitriol?
I have to wonder, like, I do feel like it's part of a broader problem where there is a generation of people who feel like they don't have a voice. They feel like the only way that they can be heard is through threat, because that's all that they've seen in media. They know that if they call a bomb threat into the CEO of Sony's plane, it's going to get attention. What the things that they care about are going to get attention. And like, how awful that we've gotten to a point where that's how somebody feels, that the only way that they can be listened to is through a threat. And it sort of draws into a broader conversation about, I was just talking to some friends of mine the other day who recently, a friend of mine, Jennifer Sherl, was tweeted at by Notch. She posted an image that went viral about mansplaining. And Notch was like, this is bullshit. And basically said it was sexist towards men. And whether he intended to or not, called down his, you know, 3.2 or whatever it is, million followers on poor Jen. And Jen received an insane amount of abuse, death threats, rape threats, over 5,000 tweets over a week of
Holy
abuse.
Shit.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was bad. And we were having a conversation about, should she talk about the death threat? Because if she talks about them, it validates, you know, it gives them the attention that they want.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them the response that they want. But if she doesn't talk about them, is that a bad thing? Like, how, like, where's the line here? Like, we have to talk about these things. They're important to talk about. But if we talk about them, we're validating the very people who are doing these terrible things. When attention is what they want, how do we talk about these issues in a way that, you know, safe, I guess? And I think that it's, I mean, that's a very extreme example. but I think that it's kind of the same when we're talking about fandom. Like, there are these people who are invested in these, whether it's a cultural idea or paradigm or an IP or a comic that they really care about. They feel like the only way that they can be heard is to threaten. And then how should we respond to that as creators? Should we ignore it and, you know, not give them the satisfaction? Or should we be very public about it and both give the person who's threatening the validation that they got it, they provoked a response out of her, but explain that this is the reality and this needs to stop?
Yeah. Well, question for both of you before we kind of move on to the next segment is, what part does nostalgia play in this? Because a lot of these franchises like Captain America, Ghostbusters, and to some degree older game franchises like Baldur's Gate have a lot of people like my age range in their 40s that grew up with it, and they've got this nostalgic ideal of it, or this kind of romanticized ideal, if I can be bold about it, that this is what I grew up with, this is my childhood, how dare you change it? And that's where a lot of the vitriol comes from.
In the context of Ghostbusters or Captain America?
Both. And Baldur's Gate. Like, the original Baldur's Gate is, what, 20 years old at this point?
Yeah.
I feel like the people sending death threats over Captain America are probably not sincere, because if you've been reading, I remember in the 1960s cartoon, Captain America gets brainwashed by Hydra for 2 episodes. It's those sorts of plots have been happening for decades. You know,
he's
brainwashed, or
there's a difference between, like, most of those plots have been he's been brainwashed, or it's not actually him. Yeah. It's a double. It's a clone. This is the creators actually saying, no, this whole time he's been evil.
Yeah, but they're going to end up walking that back.
Are they? I mean, I don't think that matters. Like, it's the first time in history that, like, these creators are now saying, you know, definitively, like, he's evil. And I think that's a first for this series.
It's a first.
I can understand being weird about it.
Yeah, but the point I'm going with is that, whatever version of Captain America is so important to them won't cease to exist, and we won't even probably stop writing about that version of Captain America. Now, when it comes to Ghostbusters, I think it's Ghostbusters gets more complicated because of the, like, misogyny.
Well, it's misogyny, but it's also the, oh my god, you're ruining Ghostbusters, like the other one's going to go up in smoke because they made one with all women.
And the fact that they're conflating the two things as well is really interesting. The fact that, you know, yeah, they feel like they're ruining the movie, and also there's women. They're two separate things that are definitely, at least in some quarters, being like, oh, putting women in this is ruining Ghostbusters. And there are some people who are like, no, this is just a shit movie. It's got nothing to do with the new characters. It's
like me.
Very complicated. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's a complicated thing. Nostalgia and the way that we think about things is, I mean, god, human beings, we're fucked. Like, we're so complicated. We're so messy and hard to understand and hard to explain.
Yeah.
I mean, nostalgia is a really interesting one. I think that, like, in the case of Baldur's Gate, and I guess Ghostbusters and Captain America, I find it really ironic that, like, the Gamergate people and Sad Puppies and Vox Day, etc., complain about this idea of safe space, because when they're safe, when things that they perceive as their safe spaces are invaded, they react in terrible way. And I think that things like Baldur's Gate and Ghostbusters and like the Marvel comics, these are spaces where traditionally these primarily men could feel comfortable. It was stories that they felt were safe. They didn't have to be, they weren't being confronted with things they weren't comfortable with. It was a space they could go to for comfort and for pleasure and enjoyment. And now they feel that's been taken away from them. Their safe space has been in, and they would never call it a safe space ever, but that's exactly what it is. And so it's super ironic to me and super interesting that when their safe spaces are invaded, they cause this ruckus and send out all manner of horrific death threats and abuse, but, you know, when they go and invade other people's safe spaces, no, it's totally justified, it's fine.
Yeah. Oh, nostalgia. Let's burn it to the ground.
Yay!
So let's shift to something not as serious. And our friend Anna Tarkov, bless her, bless her humor and her ability to be funny for sending us some very fluffy questions for you.
Bless her cotton socks.
Bless her cotton socks?
It's literally the only American phrase I know.
It's one more than I know. I've never heard that.
It's actually kind of offensive. It's like a really condescending way of being like, oh, what a sweetie.
Oh, so like, bless your heart?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I was really confused. I was like, bless your cotton socks, what the hell? So I'll take Anna's first question. Anna, I'm going to laugh at you so hard I hope you laugh ridiculously when you hear this part of the episode. So her first question was, is it a burden to be so ridiculously good looking?
Well, you know, it does make it difficult to make my way through the hordes of people trying to touch me every morning. But I do, you know, somehow I manage bravely, and you know, my entire life is just this giant burden. It's hard. It's really hard. No, it's ridiculous, Anna. Don't be silly.
David, do you want the next question?
Anna also asks, did you major in selfies in uni?
I majored in drama, which I guess is vaguely related. No, actually, selfies is a really interesting one. Talking about, you know, I'm going to take Anna's question and I'm going to make them into something real. There's a lot of discussions that I've been having with people and have had over the past couple of years about self-image. And selfies, for me, have been a vehicle for self-empowerment. For a very, very long time, I didn't think that I was attractive, and I thought I was really unattractive. One of my friends, Ray Johnston, who was one of our guests of honor, our bosses of honor at GX Australia, she did 365 days of selfies specifically to help herself with her self-image. We talked about this a lot, and I found it really interesting and inspiring. And at first, I thought it was bullshit. Then I was like, oh, I guess I'll give it a try. And so I started taking selfies of myself and realized that, you know, when I was the one controlling the image, I felt a lot more comfortable with photos. I felt a lot more comfortable with the way that I looked. So selfies became a way for me to become more comfortable with myself and my body and the way that I looked, and definitely helped me develop a confidence that I had never had before, because I was the one in control of how I presented myself. And I think that is a really interesting view of selfies, which are traditionally looked at as this really facile, shallow thing. So there, Anna, I turned your funny question into a real serious thing.
Well, and it's also because most of the time selfies are associated with women and teenage girls, not so much guys taking them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I can find it, there was actually a really interesting article about men and the art of selfies.
Yes, that was so good.
Yeah, I was just like, huh, I'd never thought about this, because I still suck at selfies, and I always feel self-conscious. Mm-hmm. So,
self-conscious.
Very selfie-conscious. I look at pictures people take of me, even if I took the selfie, I'm just like, no. I feel like I made a tactical error in posting this photo, but it's all over the internet now, so too late.
Mm-hmm.
And Anna's last fluffy question was, who are you wearing?
God, I don't even know. I'm wearing a blue blazer, which I bought from a secondhand store in San Francisco this year. I am wearing pants from some place. I'm wearing a shirt from an Australian vendor called YD, and a scarf from my boyfriend's wardrobe.
Hopefully he is not cold while you took his scarf.
Frankly, I don't care. He's fine.
Okay, then. Well, so Liam will steal your clothes if you are dating him.
It's true. It's true. There's probably no risk of me dating anyone else, though. Right? Sebastian and I have been together 9 years, so.
Yay. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So to wrap up and continue to be a bit silly, we usually talk about what we've been playing, and I'm kind of laughing at your reply.
Which is, oh, God, I have no time to play games.
So in theory, if you had time to play games, what would you like to be playing?
What would I like to be playing? I would like to break into BioWare and steal an alpha copy of Mass Effect Andromeda. I'm very excited for that game.
I'm excited. I'm doing my own embargo like I did before Inquisition came out, of not looking at anything unless it's official.
Yeah.
And even then, kind of like, do I really want to know?
Exactly. I love BioWare. I'm super excited to see where it goes next. I heard some really exciting things from Manvia when he was over. Just talked about how much like polish and effort they're putting into making it the way that they want to make it, and the fact that they delayed it it made me really, really happy, because contrary to popular belief, every time a title is delayed, it actually gets better.
I know. Oh, I'm excited. There will be much flailing and squeeing once this game is in my hands.
Mm-hmm.
David, what have you been playing or thinking about deeply?
All right, so I haven't actually had much time to play any games recently. I think I did actually play, like, Sid Meier's Pirates while I was editing the podcast.
Okay.
But over the weekend, I wrote a pitch to a comedy website about Fallout 4, and I've just been thinking about it. The pitch sort of ends up hitting on something like very deep and more layered than Bethesda had recently been capable of.
Okay.
And the only time I've really seen that before from them was in Morrowind, which is, if you've never read it, there was this whole blog post this person wrote called The Metaphysics of Morrowind, how the character of Vivek hit on the central theme of Morrowind in being more or less aware he was a video game character. That was his basic superpower.
Huh.
Interesting.
And in Far Harbor, when you meet Dima, he's presented to you in the same way Vivek was. You go into a poorly lit corridor that opens into a poorly lit dome where he is sitting in the center. And Dima asks you if you're a synth, which are Fallout replicants, if that needs a saying. And no matter what you say, he treats it as a deeply philosophical question. It is a question about the nature of the self, because there's no way for you to find out. The only test they have kills you.
Wow.
And then, you know, if you remember the main plot, the guy who makes sense is your son. So I pitched to a comedy website that your son is your dad, who has created you as a killing machine. Do the stuff you're going to do anyway.
That's kind of deep.
Interesting.
And it's holding up better than I thought it would for a comedy pitch.
You'll have to keep us updated on how that goes. And as for me, I spent a good part of today getting my ass kicked in The Witcher 3 DLC, Blood and Wine.
How is it?
Oh, I did forget to say it, though. Unless you play survival mode, because the synths don't sleep.
Oh, great. That's going to give me a nightmare. Thanks. Blood and Wine is amazing. It is beautiful. It is also a very big download. It is almost 13 gigs of content.
That seems like basically a whole new short game.
Yes, it's more like an expansion than a short add-on. And there was another update patch because the menu changed. They did a lot of tweaks to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you run into a giant very early, and there's now video of me screeching like I'm playing Dark Souls. Because I did not expect a giant 10 minutes into this DLC. And being hard-headed, I didn't change the difficulty until I got to the Bruja. And I was like, why, God, is there a Bruja in this game? Because she's invisible and can, basically take you out in a few hits.
Jesus.
And, I'm going to make a highlight reel, because I got taken out in, less than a minute, because she basically starts off the fight by getting you from behind. And unless you turn around and swipe back at her, you are pretty much out for the count in about a minute, minute and a half.
Wow.
And that's on normal difficulty. So I was like, fuck it, going back to Dragon Age.
Yep. I'd just be like, haha, fuck this shit. Story
I'm out. Yeah, I think I might even start saying, fuck this shit, I'm out, as I stop the stream, because it crossed over from a challenge to frustration.
Yeah.
So the first boss in the Hearts of Stone DLC was the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm going to let that alone for a minute. I may go back and replay the character I finished the game with instead of starting a new game. Because you can start a game with a character level 34 and just do the DLC if you want, rather than a whole new game, unless you have a Geralt built at 34 or higher. So yeah, that was fun. And I did the Winter Palace again in Dragon Age Inquisition, which is always a fun time. So that was that. That was my day. But I know you have to get your work day started, and it's still early for you. And it's about dinner time for us over here. And still, we're talking to you in the future because it's like Friday for you already.
It is Friday. It's 4 minutes till 10 a.m. on a Friday.
Ooh. See, listeners are so awesome. We can broadcast into the future.
Magical. Magical, I tell you.
You are magical.
Our listeners will be listening to this a week from now.
Mm-hmm. So technically, we're speaking to you from the past. Future. Does that mean we're broadcasting into the future?
Yes.
Yeah.
We'll take it.
We're just that good.
It's time travel, no matter how you slice it.
But speaking of time travel and things like that and where you are, how can people find you online, Liam?
The best way is Twitter. I'm constantly on Twitter and ignoring my work at Liam Esler, LIAMESLER. And you can find GX Australia at GX Australia, oddly enough.
Who would have imagined? David, where can people find you?
I can be found on Twitter at Red Conversation. I can be found on patreon.com/redconversation. And I can be found at davidlreeves.com, which is basically just a contact form, or I think it just links to my email address now because the form was broken.
Oh dear.
You know, about editing services.
Yes.
And where can we find you, Tanya?
I am Cypher of Tear everywhere, literally, except for LiveJournal. I still have a LiveJournal, even though it's 15 years old.
Boo.
Why? What do you have against LiveJournal?
Mostly that all of my embarrassing 13-year-old poetry is on it.
Well, you can lock it and not tell anyone what it is.
I do. Oh, that's,
that is my fanfiction.net account. No one will find it. But I am Cypher Tear, which is CypherOftyr. On Twitter, Tumblr, Twitch, my website, and if you're a gaming type person, which hopefully you are listening to this podcast, that is where you'll find me on PS4, Steam, and Xbox Live. And with that, we are sadly done, because I always enjoy talking to you, Liam, and I don't want to let you go, but we have stuff to do that is not the podcast.
What? What?
I know. Thank you so much for making time to talk to us today.
Ah, thank you for having me. It was lovely to have a chat.
Yeah, it was great to have you.
Yes, and next week we will be talking with Samus. Not Maddie Myers, sadly, although we'd love to have Maddie on the show, but Nongo, also known as Samus the Rapper, for our one-year anniversary recording.
Very exciting.
Yes, I'm so stoked to talk to Samus.
She's amazing.
So yeah, she is. So yeah, when you're listening to this, it will be a couple days from our first anniversary, and y'all should give Liam and GamerX Australia a lot of love. So we will talk to you in a week. Bye. ¶¶